From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek. Our moderator is columnist for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Tensions between the White House and Democrats in Congress over a variety of issues. This while talk of impeaching President Donald Trump grows. Britain's prime minister has resigned. Big elections in India and Indonesia. And tariffs, technology, and trade. We'll talk about the ongoing trade spat between the U.S. and China. Well, our global listeners might not know that the U.S. government is actually comprised of three parts. There's the executive branch, which, of course, is the president. There's the legislature, which is Congress. And then there is the judiciary, which is the court system, the Supreme Court, and so forth. Well, right now, two of those branches, Congress and the president, are really arguing about a whole bunch of things. Steve Goldstein, we'll begin with you. Nancy Pelosi, the powerful Speaker of the House, second in line for the presidency, and the president himself, really arguing, and it's getting quite personal and nasty.
Yeah, nasty is being one of Trump's favorite words. And, you know, you expect this sort of sharp criticism coming from Trump, but I think Speaker Pelosi shows she can give it out as well as take it in. And so really you had both leaders raising questions about the fitness of each other, not simply that the policies that they have. You had Speaker Pelosi first talk about the need for intervention for Trump by his family and saying she prayed for him. Those comments did not go well. We had this week a planned bipartisan summit on infrastructure completely fall apart, possibly a staged bit of theater. But what it did really show is that the two sides are really making personal attacks on each other. You had Pelosi, you know, questioning Trump's really ability, his mental fitness, and Trump firing back with some videos, very selectively edited, you know, showing her stuttering during a speech, as well as some false videos that suddenly seem to be circulating of an origin nobody seems to know about. So we knew that this White House would fight aggressively. We also know that Speaker Pelosi is willing also to get in there. And she's used to governing under a Republican president. People seem to forget her time under President Bush, and she was also effective there. The result of this is that Washington is at a total standstill over policy. We had a disaster bill only barely get through Congress, which is really not controversial whatsoever. And on infrastructure, where the two parties are not hugely apart, nothing at all is getting done.
More specifically, Jonathan, some of the things that the president seems really defensive about are things that these Democrats are really trying to get their claws on. His tax returns, for example. They also want the president's former lawyer, a gentleman by the name of Don McGahn, to testify in the White House, is not cooperating on any of these fronts. What happens now?
Well, what happens now is that the Democrats in the House are pressing ahead with subpoenas for both documents and for members of the administration and from the White House to testify. But these people are absolutely stonewalling. The White House is refusing to allow any documents to go out or any people to testify. And the more the administration does this, the greater the talk of impeachment grows. Now, Nancy Pelosi feels that it's premature for impeachment right now. However, there is a growing minority within the Democratic Party, the Democratic caucus in the House, to begin impeachment proceedings. She's trying to hold them back, but yet she has to give them some sort of red meat. So hence you have the sharp comments that she's making about Trump, which are very calculated to not only get under Trump's skin, but also to mollify the growing calls for impeachment.
She's really trying to walk a fine line here. And a lot of people have sort of compared the situation we're in to the Watergate situation back in 1973, 74, when President Nixon was being investigated for Watergate. And people say, well, now this is different because polls aren't in favor of impeachment. But in 1974, they really weren't in favor of impeachment either until impeachment hearings actually began. And then the evidence started coming out. Is that sort of where we are?
Well, yeah. there have been suggestions for that. A congressman named Jamie Raskin, from a second-term congressman from Maryland, has said, we don't have to impeach Trump at the moment, but we can begin impeachment hearings. And this will serve two purposes. One of the reasons that the White House is refusing to hand over documents and to send people over in answer to these subpoenas is that they're claiming that there's no legislative purpose behind these requests. Now, that's sort of a dubious legal argument, but what Jamie Raskin is saying is if we begin impeachment hearings, then there's a legislative purpose. It's the impeachment hearings themselves, which would make the courts more amenable to approving these requests. Now, there have been two requests approved by the court, by federal courts, which are requests for Trump's financial documents, both from his accountant and from Deutsche Bank, who's lent him a lot of money. So that's basically where things stand right now.
And also his tax returns, not necessarily an IRS issue, but the state of New York, where his state taxes are filed. Two, it appears that the climate there may be much more amenable to releasing his taxes, which, of course, would tell us an awful lot about his federal returns as well. Steve, there's one thing that you mentioned that I want to come back to, and that's this legislative gridlock that we have here. The president says that I'm not going to cooperate with Congress on things like you mentioned, infrastructure, and I think drug pricing is another one. But at some point, things have to get done. We have to have a budget, for example, all kinds of things that absolutely have to be done. I mean, how long can this standoff really go on? I mean, they've got to get these other things done.
Well, I think they're going to go for the bare minimum. You know, he was actually asked this question quite directly yesterday. Trump was. And he pointed out, you know, that they do need Congress to ratify the trade agreement with Mexico and Canada that he hails as a vast improvement over NAFTA. I think more sober analysis would say it's a slight improvement. I wouldn't expect much in terms of action on Congress, even, again, where there isn't much dispute, you know, between the two sides on issues like infrastructure, drug pricing. Even this trade deal is very much in doubt, and it's not a really radical departure from what we've seen. But there's very little appetite on Democrats to help him. And on the other side, the Republicans don't, I think, would rather have a political theater where they can accuse the Democrats of holding things back rather than going forward.
I just wanted to add one point. You know, we have an election coming up in 2020, and traditionally, not very much gets done as you the closer you get to the beginning of the election year, which isn't really that far away. When you think about it, though, the only thing that Congress is really required to do is to pass appropriations bills. The Congress has the power of the purse, and they are supposed to pass 14 different appropriations bills. That's the minimum. And that's what I expect will happen. And if they can't pass the appropriations bills, then we have a thing called a continuing resolution, which basically Congress agrees to maintain funding at the previous levels for however long that continuing
usually
resolution
usually very short for. Period of time.
Yes. But although there have been some continuing resolutions that have gone on for more than a year.
Now, before we go to break, there's one thing that the president also mentioned this week when he said that Congress can't do their legislative work and investigate me at the same time. They don't have that kind of bandwidth. They have to do one or the other. But it's worth pointing out that in the midst of Watergate, even while President Nixon was being investigated top to bottom by Congress, Congress passed and Nixon signed, here's a quick list, the Federal Aid Highway Act, the Rehabilitation Act of 1970, 73 of the Endangered Species Act, the War Powers Resolution, the Budget Act of 1974, on and on and on. So Congress can walk and chew gum at the same time. So the presidents claim that they have to do one thing or another. History suggests that's probably not so. In any case, let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. Did you know you can download our program? It's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Jonathan Broder, Contributing Editor at Newsweek. Our moderator is columnist for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Welcome back. The trade war between the United States and China drags on. Both sides are hitting the other with tariffs, and now the battle seems focused also on technology. Steve, the U.S. really seems worried about technology in particular. Explain.
Well, part of it is that U.S. companies that go over to China end up transferring much of their sophisticated technology to China as part of these joint ventures that China requires. And then the other related issue is you have many companies that report very sophisticated Chinese espionage to take their technologies directly without their consent, without any payment. At least in the joint ventures, you know, companies get compensated. So you have it both by agreement and by coercion, China taking the key technologies for the future. And so that is a point that really you have China in the trade talks not really wanting to bend on. They do seem amenable to the idea of purchasing more goods and services from the U.S., but not to changing their rules, and certainly not to restricting, you know, the technology shift toward them, which they see, of course, is incredibly valuable.
It seems to me that the real issue is here. We keep talking about farmers and soybean sales have plummeted, this and that, but technology is really the driving issue here, and China with its 2025 plan is really just on this huge drive to dominate in things like, we know what they are, I mean, artificial intelligence and 5G and quantum computing, robotics, on and on. They're pouring money into their space program. Everybody knows it's these things and not soybeans that are going to determine economic and national security dominance of this century. And I think, does that explain, Jonathan, why, as Steve said, they're not giving in here?
Yes, but there's also a larger issue on which Steve touched on. What the Trump administration wants is changes in actual Chinese law and changes in the structure of their economy. They want fewer government supports for state-run industries. And, you know, if you do that, then a lot of people lose their jobs. When I was over in China last year, we spoke to some Chinese economists. We asked, well, just how many people losing their jobs is politically acceptable to President Xi Jinping? And he gave an enormous number, a number that just boggled my mind. He said, we could get by if, let's say, 60 or 70 million people lost their job. That would be politically acceptable.
These Chinese resistance to changing their laws, I mean, they see that as an infringement upon their sovereignty, don't they?
Oh, yes, they do. And what's been interesting in the last few weeks is that Chinese state media, or at least the English translations that I have to rely on, but it's certainly turned very sharper in tone and drawing on nationalist sentiment in China, which is, of course, very much still there. So that's a reservoir that they had not really tapped up until now. So that's what's really changed about the trade talks over the last few weeks. So they are absolutely digging in on this issue.
It's also possible, Jonathan, just a second, that, you know, these Chinese talk to Chinese officials here. They won't say this explicitly, but they're sort of hinting that, you know, maybe they're looking beyond President Trump. They're thinking, well, he might not get reelected. There's an election, in a year and a half or so here. There might be somebody else in office who is easier to deal with, so perhaps they're trying to drag things out.
That's true. I mean, the Chinese always have played the long game.
Right.
But the question of nationalism is very, very important here. Xi Jinping represents a leadership style in China that is rather muscular. They feel they've come into their own. Their economy is strong. Their military is strong. People have jobs. And Xi Jinping often talks about the century of humiliation. This is the century that began with the Opium Wars back in the 1850s, when Britain basically forced their way into China with gunboat diplomacy.
The Boxer Rebellion.
Right, and took over Hong Kong for 100 years. They were weak then. They're strong now. They don't have to tolerate dictates from the United States.
All right. Well, let's move on here. No shortage of big news elsewhere in the world. Let's start quickly with something that happened at the late end of this week, the resignation of British Prime Minister Theresa May. No surprise there over her failure to get Britain out of Brexit, or out of the European Union, rather. What happens now?
Well, there's a leadership debate, or really within her party, the Tories. And really what was interesting is that May tried to sell this idea of a so-called soft Brexit, so that UK would exit the European Union in a way that really wouldn't change the terms of trade arrangements very much. It would probably restrict immigration. That was her vision. It wasn't really an unreasonable one, but she couldn't persuade members of her own party, and she didn't get the public to rally behind her. So she tried, as she points out, three times to get it through, and she couldn't get it done. And so what's left is really support for a harder Brexit, with very few agreements with the European Union on the way out. I would say an arrangement would probably lead to less trade with the EU than what May had imagined, probably more disruptive to the economy. Huge questions over what happens in Northern Ireland, which, as we've seen for decades, is a very sensitive a place, and they had since, say, the late 90s, and under what Blair and Clinton managed to accomplish, a peaceful arrangement. So that's very much in doubt now. And it looks like perhaps the former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson might end up becoming Prime Minister.
A separatist movement in Scotland as well, right?
Oh, everybody's trying to get out. Get out, get in. The whole UK arena is incredible, which speaks to the difficult job that Theresa May had. Forces really pulling her in every which way. But it also showed that she was not able to steer the country in any direction.
Now, what makes anyone think that Boris Johnson is going to do a better job?
Nothing. it's funny. Usually when we were talking about this before, but usually when a prime minister loses a major vote in the parliamentary system, the prime minister resigns. As Steve said, she lost three times. And the reason why she didn't resign and another figure didn't come to take her place was because at that time, nobody even wanted the job. Nobody was coming forward to say, except for the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, nobody in the Conservative Party was calling for her to step down because they didn't want the job themselves. So Britain is going to remain in basically, at least until they choose a new, the Conservative Party chooses a new prime minister, Britain will remain basically in a state of flux, particularly when it comes to Brexit. As Steve said, there will be probably a hard Brexit if Boris Johnson becomes the prime minister, and that is going to cause tremendous economic dislocation. Right now, under the EU rules, if you are a member of the EU, you get to move people, labor, goods, across borders without any checks. If you are a restaurant in London and you get strawberries or flowers or whatever from Holland that morning, they leave Holland that morning, they come across the channel, you can serve them on the table that night. Now, those same products are going to have to go through border checks. It's going to be very, very difficult.
So what has the impact been for the last couple of years, Steve, your economic guy, on the British economy in the last couple of years?
Well, it's important to point out they haven't actually Brexited yet. So if you look at the UK economy, it certainly hasn't been bad. Unemployment's very low, actually very similar jobs market to here in the U.S.
It's the uncertainty,
but
though.
But it's the uncertainty. Yeah. So that there's a lack of investment, both by companies, but also by households. Why would you make a major purchase or extend your house or whatever it is that you want to do in your own life when you don't know if you have a job or you don't know if your job will pay as much in the future? So when you have that uncertainty that weighs on the economy, it's grown slower than it would have. But, you know, so far, since they haven't actually Brexited, UK economies, it's doing okay. Let me just add one thing real quick. If they do a Brexit, and yes, they will have this disruption, but finally, they also will have clarity. Companies and people could then make decisions. Okay, this is our situation. What do we do now? So I've had people tell me, okay, yes, there will be this disruption, but also that there might be a burst of investment because finally people will know what the situation is.
Now, quickly, I want to talk about two countries, two big and important countries in Asia that have had recent elections. First, India, world's biggest democracy. 600 million people voted, I think, over a period of about 6 or 7 weeks. The prime minister there, Narendra Modi, looks like he's going to be in office for another 5 years. What's the significance of this?
Narendra Modi comes from a part of the BJP party, which is a Hindu nationalist party. For many, many years, India came under the rule of the Congress party, which was basically ruled by the Gandhi dynasty. Narendra Modi has now emerged as an extremely powerful leader. He has a sweeping mandate to rule. His party won, I think, almost 350 seats in the 500-seat parliament, or roughly 500-seat parliament. It means he doesn't even have to form a coalition government.
And isn't that extraordinary in India? Usually, don't they have these incredible coalitions of multiple parties?
Yes, and this is the first time, I think, in 50 years that a party has won that kind of majority in two consecutive elections, which just shows the depth of his popularity. What it also means is that Hindu nationalism is now ascendant in India, which worries a lot of Muslims. They're 15% of the population, but that's 300 million people. A third thing is that the Congress Party of the Gandhi dynasty was eviscerated by this election. I would say the last thing is that the markets are very, very happy with Modi's election.
And quickly, there was also an election in Indonesia, not just the world's biggest Muslim country, also the world's third biggest democracy as well. What's the significance of the Indonesian election?
Well, I would argue pretty much the same, where you do have a re-election, and you do have a sort of a nationalist move. And there, interestingly, it's the Muslim majority that wants fewer rights for minorities there. And I think there are parallels not just between Indonesia and India, but really if you look around the world, in the UK, in the United States, Trump and Modi going back to India are very close as U.S. and Indian leaders go. So you do see this movement around the world towards sort of populism and nationalism. And it seems to be on the ascendant. And I haven't really seen many counterexamples of late.
And the new president there, continuing president there, Joko Widodo, of course, has been called sort of a moderate technocrat, reputation for being a more diverse kind of leader than his opponent was. We'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Jonathan Broder, he's contributing editor at Newsweek, and Steve Goldstein, he's Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch. Thank you very much, gentlemen. This program was produced by Patrice Martin, our engineer Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you for joining us.